Colitotherus cornutus, the forked fungus beetle that occurs in bracket fungi, is another common species, but nonetheless a pretty cool one that occurs throughout the eastern United States. Some flightless forms. We have quite a few flightless forms included in the Lagrianes, Opatrines, Tenebrianines, and Coelomatopines. Here's Etokia, Picea, a Tenebrianine. And then one of the more vagile groups, the Alaculines, represented here by Locopoda. Those are the ones that will come into lights if you set up light traps or your black lightning and stuff. The Alaculines, which are much more vagile than some of these other darkling beetles, will come into lights. The habitat specialist, you saw Amodinus fossor a little bit earlier, but again, the morphology is specialized for existence in sand, and the legs are modified for burrowing or sand swimming. These are flightless, and they occur throughout a good portion of the eastern United States, but in a lot of places there are these isolated microdeserts that you find them in. And the picture there up on top is Wisconsin, Blue River Sand Barrens up in Wisconsin, that you can find this this species. It also occurs along the dunes and beach, sands along the Atlantic Ocean. Again, not in Florida though. It would be interesting to find, but haven't found it yet down there. Some of the things that get in to the country, and these things are coming in all the time, and we have 15 cosmopolitan species in the eastern United States. So there's Alphatobius and Tribolium and Pilaris and some of those genera. Approximately 7 species were recently introduced to Florida, and I've highlighted some of them here. Lichenum is one of the ones that has been here for a while. I think it got in like 1906. Bacilla crypticus is one of them from South America. This is a diaperine. Some other immigrants, Soropria. Warren has just written a paper up on Soropria. That is from Asia. It occurs only in southern Florida. Again, another diaperine. This European thing that we've seen a little bit earlier, that's not a scarab, occurs from Maryland to Florida. Again, another diaperine. And these things have been handpicked. Warren collects these things when he's out in the field, taking in traps and the shipments of organic products as far as how some of these things get in. And most of these introductions are probably, a lot of them are associated with products having some kind of fungal growth, because a lot of these things are diaperines that get in here. Some beneficials, the Curtisia species are facultative bark beetle predators. They're typically associated with pine. They're feeding on fungi and stuff, but they actually do occasionally feed on immature and adult bark beetles. And then if you think about it, most Tenebrionic species aid in decomposition of organic materials. So Tenebrionas are beneficial insects. Some undescribed species. There's a couple of species that Warren is describing in Neatus. There's one here on the left. I found specimens of this one, I believe, in a tree hole back when I was doing my master's research, and I think this is one of the ones that he's now describing as a new species. Neatus tenebroides is very common in the eastern United States. That was the only one we thought we had, but there are apparently two more. I think there's an undescribed species of Maricantha in Florida. The Maricantha has been monotypic, and in the panhandle there's something that looks much different. It has been called Maricantha contracta, but upon closer look, the punctation on the pronotum, the interstrial punctation, is different. They're smaller. The male genitalia is different. It's a different species, and that needs to be described. Warren is also describing two additional Helops species and another Eutokia, which he collected in Florida. So there are certainly a bunch of undescribed species out there. The reference guide we have in PrEP, the Darkling Beetles of the Eastern United States, University Press has expressed interest in it, and they're just waiting for us to provide them the manuscript now. But this will include species accounts, and those accounts will include synonymies, diagnoses, life histories, and distributions for the 200 and some odd species of Tenebrionids in the eastern U.S., and then some good images, keys, and then relevant literature for these darkened beetles. And this was possible, at least the color images. I don't know if we're going to maybe have like one plate of color images. But funding for this has been provided by the Florida Agricultural Experimental Station. and the entomology and nematology department at the University of Florida. So just in summary, there are about 250 known species of Tanebs in, east of the Mississippi River. A lot of the life histories and immature descriptions are still lacking. There's this hidden diversity and several undescribed species. I'm not even sure if I covered all of the ones that Warren has in prep. And some Tanebs have color. There's a few more that have color than what I showed you today. But I just want to say that these guys do represent a significant component of our regional entomofauna, but they, and they are still poorly understood. And if we think about biodiversity and conservation, how do we begin to manage and conserve things we don't even really know much about? And I'm hoping this reference guide is a catalyst for similar work. Hopefully we can get more publications like this out here on groups that don't have a lot of color and stuff like that, like darkling beetles. And this will be important in understanding the true diversity of Tenebrionids, Coleoptera, and insects in general. I just want a couple of acknowledgments. John Caponera, who's our departmental chair, has provided funding for this reference guide. Mark McClellan, Dean of Research at the University of Florida, has also provided funding. And then the resources at Entomology and Nematology, Florida State Collection of Arthropods, Department of Entomology, University of Wisconsin, and the National Museum of Natural History. And then some of these folks at the bottom here provided images in the past few years for this reference guide. And then I just want to acknowledge Alistair, our good friend. That's all I have.
There's a project that was done in collaboration with Rolf Albu and Bob Pake. The revision of the genus, will be out in the next issue of Coleopt Bulletin. I'm going to talk today about these metapopulations in the Chattamoxes. And I guess I should start by defining what I mean by metapopulation. For those of you who weren't at the symposium yesterday, there are a couple of books about them. And I would explain just by using an example of a familiar critter, the porcupine. Porcupines basically eat pine trees, so their habitat is pine forest. And in the western U.S., at least, the pine forests are found on the mountains, which are surrounded by deserts, which are not good porcupine habitat. And therefore, the population of porcupines are fragmented. And so these metapopulations are more or less isolated from other populations. And of course, isolation is one of the major factors driving evolution and speciation. But an important part of this concept is that the degree of isolation is not really complete. I remember the first time I saw a porcupine in Death Valley, I thought, what in the heck is a porcupine doing out here? And since then I've seen them several times, typically run over on I-10 or I-70. And the short answer is he's looking for the next Mrs. Porcupine. But part of that concept is that there is some gene flow. It's not just isolation in a physical sense, but also a temporal sense. So that if a population or metapopulation goes extinct, with time it might be reestablished. And that's the concept I want you to think about when I talk about these Chattamoxes. This project began, like so many do, because somebody sent me a specimen to identify, and Bob Pate sent me a specimen which turned out to be a Chattamoxes, which was pretty remarkable at the time, because when we started this project, the only known specimens were the types of, in fact, the Chattamoxes wagneri, the type species, was only known from a single holotype, which had been found dead in Death Valley. And a remarkable thing about it was when Blaisdell described it, he remarked that he believed the species would probably turn out to be subterranean. And this was based on a single dead specimen. I thought, well, what was the clues that gave away? What made him think that might be subterranean? Even more remarkable, it turns out he's probably correct, because when the next species was discovered, which was a Chattamoxes tanneri from Utah, the types were taken out of a pack rat mound, and except for two of the specimens were actually dug out of a cliff swallow nest. So somebody was out there looking for invertebrate nest, and they found these beetles. A few years after Blaisdell described the Chattamoxes wagneri, he published another paper in which he said a second specimen had been found in Riverside County. And so my colleague Rolf Albu traipsed over there to Cal Academy and took a look at it, and this is what he found. and it's a different species. It's an undescribed species. We're describing it for Fred Andrews because he got a series in pitfall traps. I can work the mouse here. Notice that this species has a complete marginal bead here separating the dorsum from the ventral part of the pronotum. Whereas in Wagneri, it does not have a marginal bead. In fact, Blaisdell used the lack of a marginal bead here as a character for describing the genus. So what he was smoking when he thought that was the same species, I'd like to get some. But the other thing I want to point out about Wagneri, note the size of the eye. And as good taxonomists, for perspective, let's compare the distance to the cervix here. So the greatest ocular diameter is about equal to the distance to the cervix. And compare that to the species that we got, that Bob Pape found, which the ocular diameter, there were at least two ocular diameters in the cervix here, a much smaller eye. And this beetle was found in a cave. And it was found in a place called Bat Cave, not because Batman operates out of there, but because of a large population, over a million Mexican free-tailed bats that live in that cave. It also has, you'll notice, it does not have a complete marginal bead, but it does have kind of a ruga here on the pronotum. So this is an undescribed species that we're naming Foleater. Well, and I get back to what Blaisdell might have been looking at. There's a convergence in cave beetle morphology. They tend to have a fiddle shape with long legs. And of course, these true cave beetles, troglophilic beetles, are blind. They have no eyes. So our beetle, he's not there yet, but he does have reduced size of the eyes. Now, this is the cave. When we told the National Park Service in Grand Canyon that we're going to describe a new species from Bat Cave, they asked, would you please not put the locality in the description? Which, of course, we can't do that. But the reason was because they're afraid that, well, they're talking about you guys, you dastardly beetle collectors, will go there and wipe out the population. Well, I invite you to go there because to get to this cave, you're going to have to crawl 600 feet of a cliff. And to get to the base of the cliff, you're going to have to take about a 10-day whitewater raft trip down the Colorado River to get to that point. So I'm going to take you on a virtual beetle collecting trip into the cave here. This is Bob Pape's expedition financed by the National Park Service to survey the fauna of this cave. And I'm going to have a little story to talk about that scaffold, that structure that's down there at the base of the cave here. And here's Bob Pape as he's about to enter into our bat cave. Prior to the 1965, the Bat Cave was actually exploited for guano. They mined the guano out of that cave. Like I say, there's over a million Mexican free-tailed bats that occupy the cave. And in order to do this, incredibly enough, if you look across the canyon, you can just make out that scaffold down there over here, which is on the north rim. They ran a cable across the canyon to this structure here, winch housing, that had this large bucket that they would fill with the guano and tote it across the here to what they call Guano Point. Now you can imagine how many beetles were in that guano, which is one of the points I'm trying to make on this part of the story. This all ended in 1965 when one of our top guns from Nellis Air Base decided to buzz the canyon and didn't know that the cable was there. Took out the cable, took out his jet, ended tragically for the pilot, and they never restarted the guano operation. In fact, now the Park Service, in order to restore the canyon to its natural site, this is now a restaurant, and the Navajo tribe has put out a skywalk here, which will be probably the closest I'll ever get to Bat Cave. I know Chuck Triplehorn will be on the next whitewater trip out there. Anyway, so let's go into the cave and take a look. This is the beetle in its habitat in the cave. The floor of the cave is covered with the bat guano and dead bat skeletons. Bob mapped out the localities where he could actually find each circle represents where he found a beetle. He didn't collect them all. He just marked where he found them. This is about 200 meters from the entrance back to this constriction. The bats used to roost back